The main point is, when you deal with what's missing inside of you, those absences will not be transferred to your children. 8. Difficulty nurturing versus giving and caring. When you were growing up emotionally neglected, you probably experienced gaps in the nurturance you got from your parents. Perhaps you were cared for very well in some areas, physically, for example, but not in others. Nurturing is like a warm type of caretaking. It's giving paired with care. Remember Dave, who had such a hard time with nurturance that he resented his daughter for making him care about her? Dave was, as we talked about, like a sponge too long away from water. His emotional self had become dry and brittle, so he had great difficulty taking anything in and giving anything out. Your job now, as a parent who had spotty nurturing at best from your parents, is to make sure that your child never runs dry. Every special thing you do to make sure your child feels taken care of sets him up to be able and willing to give that to others. You will want your child to have the best possible success in his own marriage and with his own children. If you give him plenty of warm caretaking throughout his life, he will have it in copious amounts to give to the people he loves. Here are some ideas to help you provide your child with emotional nurturance. Spontaneously give your child a hug when you notice he looks sad. Ask her if she's okay if you think she might be upset. Spend extra time with your child when you feel he needs it. If your child is going through a transition or any difficult phase, for example, school starting or ending, a move, change of friends, etc., talk about it with her and do something special for her to show that you notice what she's going through. Be aware in general of what he is feeling. Help him become aware of his feelings and put words to them. Accept and validate those feelings. He will experience all of this as nurturing. 9. Poor self-discipline versus in control. As we talked about before, your own struggles with self-discipline quite likely reflect something about the discipline you received from your parents. Children left to their own devices will quickly learn to indulge themselves. They may also learn how to be quite hard on themselves. They may learn to call themselves lazy, a procrastinator, or a shopaholic. What they will not learn is how to make themselves do what they don't want to do and how to stop themselves from doing what they shouldn't do. Your child will not learn this either, unless you give her what you have trouble providing for yourself: structure, clear rules, and appropriate, predictable consequences. Structure. When you provide structure for your child, you're teaching him how to structure himself. For example, bedtime is 9 o'clock on school nights. That's a reasonable rule. As you set and enforce it with your child, you're teaching her how to set a rule in her own head and follow it. Another example might be an hour of homework after school before she can go outside. This forces her to override her own impulses at your behest. When she's older and has control over her own time, she'll carry that ability to overrule her impulses with her. If she can structure herself, she'll be far less likely to procrastinate. Rules. Once you've set up a structure for your child that's firm but reasonably flexible, it's really important to make that structure clear to your child. To some extent, self-discipline is the ability to set clear rules for oneself and then make oneself follow them. That's what healthy discipline involves in your role as parent. Make sure the rules are clear, age-appropriate, and easy to follow. Post them on the refrigerator, announce them in family meeting. Don't change them without reason or without informing your child. Your child must know clearly what's expected of him. Consequences. Your child must know what will happen if he breaks a rule. If you don't take out the trash on Tuesday, there will be hell to pay. Doesn't work. If you don't take out the trash on Tuesday, I'll take away your iPod until you've done it. Does work, because the consequence is clear. If you don't take out the trash on Tuesday, I'll give your iPod to charity. Doesn't work, because that consequence is inappropriately harsh. It doesn't fit the crime. Your consequence has to be both clear and appropriate, and on top of that, it must be reliably delivered. The delivery of the consequence can't depend upon whether you're paying attention or have the energy to give it. Your child needs to know that you mean business, and he needs to know what to expect from you. Anything less will teach him nothing other than how to break rules and how to have problems with self-discipline. 10. Alexithymia versus emotionally aware. By now, you may have realized that emotional awareness is one of the greatest gifts that you can give your children. You want your child to know what she's feeling and why, and be able to put it into words. You also want her to have skills for figuring out what other people are feeling, and to be able to somewhat deduce the reasons for others' feelings and actions. These are important aspects of what Daniel Goleman calls emotional intelligence. Scientific studies conducted by Goleman show that high emotional intelligence is a greater predictor of success than is high intellectual intelligence. Emotionally intelligent people have a huge advantage in navigating the world. This includes the workplace, as well as marriage, social situations, and parenting. Knowing how important these skills are, how do you make sure that your child has them? First of all, everything we've talked about in this chapter will contribute to your child's emotional awareness. But on top of that, there is more that you can do. Your child will learn little, if anything, about emotion in school. This part of his education is up to you. Here are the 5 steps to follow to teach your child about emotion so that he'll have a high level of emotional awareness. 1. Pay attention and notice what your child is feeling. 2. Make an effort to feel what your child is feeling. 3. Put the feelings into words for her and teach her how to use her own words to express her feelings. Use the feeling word list found on my website as needed to help you with this. 4. Use your vertical questioning skills to help him understand the reasons for his feelings. 5. Make emotions an important part of life. Keep emotional language in your everyday vernacular. This alone will convey the value and importance of emotion to your child and will stimulate her interest in understanding the feeling part of life. As you were listening to this section, did you start to feel guilty? Did you judge yourself for not doing everything right? If so, it's understandable. It means that you are just like many other caring parents. No parent is fault-free. Every parent falls down in some of these areas. Every parent struggles, and every parent fails at times. As an emotionally neglected parent, you have added challenges. You must have compassion for yourself, learn from your mistakes, and continue to put in the effort as you move forward. If you were able to identify the areas in which your emotional neglect affects you, and heard in this chapter what to do about it, there's a tremendous possibility that you'll be able to correct these issues for your children. Children are amazingly resilient, so they bounce back well. Teenagers are slower to respond to parents' changes, but they do respond. You can't give in to your default settings. You must fight the fight for your own sake, as well as for the sake of your children. Parenting is one of the greatest privileges we are accorded as human beings. No matter what hand we are dealt, it's our biological and social imperative to deal an improved hand to our children. It's our job to reshuffle the cards and take more time and care than our parents did to give our children advantages that we didn't have. I promise you that there is nothing in this world that will fill your tank with a higher premium fuel than dealing your children a better hand than you received yourself. It's the most fulfilling, positive, loving, enriching, and heroic thing you will ever accomplish. You'll feel it every step of the way. Your children will become the best possible versions of themselves, and so will you. Chapter 9. For the Therapist. The concept of emotional neglect slowly became visible to me as I practiced psychotherapy over a period of 15 years. During that time, I treated a number of patients who did not seem to benefit enough from the usual tools of our trade: empathy, insight, cognitive therapy, confrontation, family or couples therapy, medication, and so on. These were the clients who I felt unable to fully understand. It seemed there was something essential missing in the clinical picture that would help make sense of the entire person, his symptoms, and his pain. It was as if I was the fabled blind man, addressing parts of the elephant, unaware that there was an entire elephant to which I should be attending. In the end, it was the valiant commitment to treatment on the part of some dedicated clients which helped me to become aware of this underlying issue. These clients were able, despite their counter-dependence, to stay with therapy over a long enough period of time for me to recognize what was occurring under the surface, name it, and address it. As this missing element slowly developed into a full model in my head, I discovered myself thinking of it with the designation emotional neglect. I could not recall having read any journal articles or books or attended any training in which emotional neglect had been a focus, yet it was a term which was familiar and carried a specific meaning for me. I became curious about whether any science existed to support the observations upon which this model was based. I spent many hours perusing the APA research libraries for journal articles, books, or academic papers that might address emotional neglect. The first thing I discovered was that the words emotion and neglect are often used together in academic and clinical writings, and this helped to explain the sense of familiarity. But rather than the actual phrase emotional neglect, the two terms typically exist together in this form: emotional abuse and neglect. Looking more carefully into this, it became clear that when emotion is addressed in this area of the literature, it is in the form of an act of commission, emotional abuse. When neglect is addressed, it is of the material and observable variety, physical neglect. I realized that the literature was not addressing the difficult to detect but equally damaging act of omission, emotional neglect. It was then that I decided to write this book. My intention and hope in writing it was to draw attention to that process I've already mentioned, omission, the oft-overlooked stepchild of parental error. I was further motivated to share the model by my observation that many of the parents who commit this error of omission are excellent parents in other ways and have the best of intentions. Further obfuscating the clinical picture for mental health professionals who are trying to understand their clients. Over the last 10 years, I have become practiced at detecting emotional neglect. I have realized that the emotional neglect must be treated, but that this is not easy since the patients themselves are focused upon their other, more noticeable symptoms. Many are resistant from the outset to the notion that they were emotionally neglected. Further complicating the treatment is the aforementioned counterdependence that is so often a part of emotional neglect, as it frequently drives these clients from treatment prematurely. I have found that when an emotionally neglected client finally recognizes his elephant, treatment can more easily access his emotional depth. From that point forward, the therapy tends to progress more rapidly. Later in this chapter, I will offer suggestions for how to identify and treat this underlying issue, including how to counter the counterdependence and address the shame, guilt, and self-blame, which tend to go along with emotional neglect. But first, let's look at the scientific literature as it relates to this model. Research. As noted earlier in this chapter, I have been unable to find studies or writings which describe or directly examine the phenomenon of emotional neglect. However, emotional neglect is closely related to two large areas of the literature. I see its nucleus at the intersection where attachment theory and emotional intelligence meet. Attachment theory offers the best demonstration of how parental acts of omission lead to symptoms of emotional neglect. The field of emotional intelligence addresses the most pivotal of all of the emotional neglect symptoms, lack of emotional awareness and knowledge. Attachment theory. The scientific understanding of the human mind has come a long way since John Bowlby wrote Maternal Care and Mental Health in 1951. Bowlby's book introduced the notion that an infant's attachment to its mother significantly impacts the personality that the infant will have as an adult. His theory was criticized and questioned by other experts of the day for being based upon too little data. Other scientists were resistant to Bowlby's ideas because they challenged the universally held belief that infants' development was based purely upon their own inner fantasy life and had nothing to do with external relationships or mothering. Fortunately, a number of other scientists have studied Bowlby's theory since that day. Some have spent many hours and days watching and recording the most subtle interactions between mothers and infants. Using longitudinal methods, they have been able to find some of those exact parent-child subtleties reflected in those same children years later. Hundreds of studies of the process of attachment have, over the last 60 years, demonstrated the importance of the emotional connection of mothers to their children. In the 1970s, psychiatrist Daniel Stern helped fine-tune our understanding of attachment by using videotaping to identify a process he called attunement. His definition of attunement involved the mother responding to the infant with emotional expression or behaviors that matched or accurately reflected the baby's emotional state. Stern posited that the mother's emotional attunement, beginning from the point of birth, communicates to the child that he is understood and that his needs will be met. This provides a solid foundation from which the child can spring forward to take risks and explore the world. Many later researchers, such as Mary Ainsworth, 1971, and Isabella and Belsky, 1991, have demonstrated the direct connection between parents' attitudes toward emotion and their children's later ability to manage, accept, and express their emotions. The plethora of research is such that few, if any, mental health professionals today would question this well-documented truth. In examining the attachment research, one can find numerous studies examining parents' out-of-tune emotional responses, such as inappropriate anger, mismatched emotional assumptions, or inaccurate emotional readings, all parental actions. But it is difficult to find research which addresses a parent's lack of emotional response, such as not noticing, not responding, or not knowing the child, the types of missing pieces that this book is about. This may be because the absence of something is difficult to observe, much less measure or document. Scientists have understandably found acts of commission more amenable to research than the acts of omission, which are so significant in emotional neglect. Given the solid scientific basis and generalized knowledge about attachment among professionals in the field, it is surprising how little this valuable concept is understood and utilized by the population at large. To us mental health professionals, it is almost a given that a particular individual's personality issues have roots in her childhood. It would be difficult to find a psychologist, psychiatrist, or social worker who has not felt the frustration of trying to lead a client to that understanding, but meeting great resistance. In my practice, I have found that many, if not most, clients are very uncomfortable with the notion that their primary caretakers had such a great effect on them. Perhaps acknowledging the incredible power of parents is inherently threatening to us all. If we understood the true impact that our parents had on us, we may feel ourselves alone, disempowered, or even victimized. If we understand the true impact that we have on our own children, we may feel terrified. So as a people, we lean more toward blaming ourselves for our own issues and underplaying the impact which we have on our children. One of my goals for this book is to make attachment theory personal, understandable, and digestible for a greater portion of the population. I believe that many people are held back from healing by their natural resistance to the idea that their childhood still significantly affects them in adulthood. I hope that the emotionally neglected will recognize themselves in the vignettes of the many fine, likable people presented in this book, and see that they too will be made stronger, not weaker, by understanding the true impact that parents have on their children's personalities. Emotional Intelligence. Daniel Goleman, Ph.D., in his 1995 book, Emotional Intelligence, defines emotional intelligence as consisting of five skills: knowing one's emotions, managing emotions, motivating oneself, recognizing emotions in others, and handling relationships. An individual who falls short on these skills can be described as having low emotional intelligence. As you can see, the concept of low emotional intelligence could then be considered to be the same as alexithymia, as defined in this book. It is interesting to consider the differences between the emotional intelligence concept and the concept of emotional neglect. In the writings about emotional intelligence, particularly the books written by Goleman, attention is paid to how low emotional intelligence develops. The mother-infant interaction described earlier via attachment theory is explored as a direct factor in the development of emotional intelligence. Also, Dr. Goleman identifies parental empathy and emotional attunement as factors contributing to emotional intelligence, as I do in this book with emotional neglect. There is a great deal of overlap, therefore, in the result: low emotional intelligence and emotional neglect symptoms, and the cause. Both are brought about by lack of parental empathy and attunement, and both results involve alexithymia. With the emotional neglect concept, I am interested in showing the inner experience of the person who is emotionally neglected as a child, and the psychological impact as it appears in the adult later in life. I am addressing the parental failure of emotional attachment and observing the developmental etiology from the perspective of clinical psychology. While Goleman considers the effects of the parental emotional failure from the perspective of emotional knowledge, I am attending to the resulting constellation of psychological symptoms: emptiness, poor self-awareness, lack of self-care, self-directed anger, self-blame, and so on. People may discover that they have low emotional intelligence through workplace training or a boss's evaluation, and they may have the opportunity to learn and develop emotional intelligence skills through that same venue. But I believe there are vast numbers of people in the world who have no idea what they're missing or why they don't have it. Ironically, they would need to have emotional awareness to realize that they don't have emotional awareness. These are the people I am targeting in this book. In the writings on emotional intelligence, Daniel Goleman and others make a strong case for considering the significance of emotional skills to life success. My goal is different. I am looking to help people who are unknowingly living their lives without these skills, to see the constellations of challenges they've been set up with, stop blaming themselves, and heal themselves and their children. Identification of emotional neglect. As noted previously, it can be difficult to detect emotional neglect, particularly as it is often buried beneath depression, anxiety, trauma, marital issues, parenting problems, grief, or some other condition which is not only clearly visible, but also the focus of the client. The emotional neglect questionnaire at the beginning of this book is designed to assist you in identifying the patients for whom emotional neglect is a factor. I fully recognize and acknowledge that as of the release of this book, no work has been done to investigate the psychometric validity or reliability of this questionnaire. Nonetheless, I decided to include it in this book because I have found it to be useful in identifying emotional neglect in my practice. Use it with full understanding of its psychometric limitations. I have found that a client who scores 6 or above is a good candidate for some level of emotional neglect, warranting further exploration. In Chapter 3, The Neglected Child, All Grown Up, 10 signs and symptoms of emotional neglect were discussed. Some of these signs are less likely to be reported or even perceived by the clients themselves. These are signs which are far more likely to be spotted by the therapist. Here are some hallmarks to watch for in your work with your patients. 1. Expressing guilt, discomfort, or self-directed anger for having feelings. Many emotionally neglected clients have apologized for crying in front of me during their therapy sessions. It is not unusual for them to precede statements of emotion with an apology, such as, "I feel terrible to say this, but I didn't really want to go to the family reunion. I know this is wrong, but I felt like walking out. I know this means I'm a bad person, but I get really angry when she does that." 2. Fiercely defending parents from therapist interpretations. The emotionally neglected are desperate to protect their parents from blame. Since they don't remember what their parents didn't do, they tend to view their parents as somewhat ideal and are naturally driven to blame themselves for their struggles. When therapy gets close to identifying ways in which his parents may have failed him, the emotionally neglected client is quick to explain that his parents did the best they could or aren't to blame. This is his way of preserving his deeply held belief that he is to blame for whatever he feels is wrong with him. 3. Doubting the substance of their memories from childhood. In my experience, many emotionally neglected patients have difficulty recalling specific things about their childhoods. Often they will report that their childhood feels like a blur that's hard to differentiate into exact events. Furthermore, the emotionally neglected often distrust their own emotional read on the childhood memories that they do have. When they're reporting their mother's temper, their father's workaholism, etc., they often pause to question the reality, importance, or validity of their memory. I feel like I'm probably exaggerating it. It wasn't really that bad, one woman said to me while tears were rolling down her cheeks. Isn't this boring for you to listen to? One man said to me while telling me about his parents' lack of reaction to the death of his dog when he was 10. Or, I don't know why I'm telling you this, it's probably not important, another man said, while relaying a story about how his cherished stepfather disappeared from his life after divorcing his mother. 4. Lacking understanding of how emotions work, their own as well as others. As discussed previously, the emotionally neglected are apt to have a low emotional intelligence quotient, but it is very difficult for the emotionally neglected to realize that their emotional understanding is poor. They grew up in families in which this was the case, and they've lived their lives this way. So it is vital for therapists to identify alexithymia for patients with emotional neglect and to name it for them. Here are some signs. Repeated physical discomfort may be evidenced by squirming or fidgeting when experiencing an emotion in your office. Telling emotionally intense stories in a way that is completely devoid of emotional content. Changing the subject quickly or resorting to humor when the therapist steers the discussion in an emotional direction. Showing a repeated inability to give answers to feeling-oriented questions. This may consist of giving intellectualized or avoidant answers. Example, intellectualized response. Question, what did you feel when she told you to leave? Answer, I thought she was being a jerk. Example, avoidant response. Question, what did you feel when she told you to leave? Answer, I hadn't realized she was that angry until she said that. 5. Counterdependence. In my experience, the emotionally neglected, more than any other clients, feel upset with themselves for needing my help. Their counterdependence asserts itself into the treatment relationship, and I have found that to be both unfortunate and fortunate. The unfortunate part is that it can be difficult to keep the emotionally neglected in treatment. The fortunate part is that I've been able to use my relationship with them to directly challenge and help them work through their shame and counterdependence. The emotionally neglected client may see her need for therapy as weak, pathetic, shameful, foolish, or frivolous. Listen for, shouldn't I be over this by now? Or, I'll bet not many 37-year-olds are still trying to learn how to say no. Or, my favorite, I don't like feeling that I need you. I want to stop treatment for a while to make sure I can do it on my own. In my experience, it can be difficult sometimes to keep them coming despite the fact that I, and even they, can see that therapy is helping them. There will be suggestions for how to use the counterdependence in the treatment in the next section. 6. Memories. As with other diagnoses and conditions, identifying emotional neglect from clients' memories can be difficult. This is especially true since when you ask clients about their childhood, they will naturally tend to relate events from that time period. As you know, it can be difficult to glean what didn't happen from their stories about what happened. But here are some suggestions for indications to listen for within their memories. Memories of a parent drastically misunderstanding the child's feelings, needs, or personality. One young woman about to obtain her bachelor's degree in social work told me about her parents' pressure upon her all through middle and high school to skip college and take over her father's brick delivery service. I found myself wondering whether these parents had any idea at all who their daughter was. Memories that entailed a parent negating, ignoring, or oversimplifying the child's emotions. For example, one neglectful mother said to her son, "Your big sister misses her father," soon after their father suddenly passed away, paying no heed whatsoever to the feelings of her son. Memories of a parent having a favorite phrase that squelches the child's emotional expression, like, "Don't be a baby," or "Get over it," or "Stop crying." Note that many mindful parents might use these phrases on occasion. It must be either used extremely inappropriately just once or used frequently to indicate that it represents a general philosophy of emotional neglect. Memories that convey significant feelings of deprivation in some non-physical area that was important to the patient as a child. "I was fascinated with the guitar, but my mom insisted that I be a violin player," for example. Or, "I really wanted to be with my friends in middle school, but my parents were very strict." Memories that seem unimportant, but have a lot of emotion attached to them. Kathleen, in Chapter 1, relayed a memory about sand play with her dad at the beach. On the surface, it seemed trivial, but it was the lack of emotional attunement from her parents that made it memorable for her. Watch for these types of intense but seemingly meaningless memories, because they are often remembered by the patient specifically because they are loaded with the invisible pain of emotional neglect. With increasing frequency, I find my clients entering treatment having already diagnosed themselves. Some people are able to see on their own that they are depressed or have anxiety, but it is unusual for a client to identify emotional neglect for himself. It is my hope that therapists will stay alert to the possibility of emotional neglect in their clients and that the aforementioned suggestions will be helpful in identifying it. Treatment. 1. Treat the presenting problem first. In most cases, the therapist will see the emotional neglect before the patient does. Since it is difficult for many clients to see their own emotional neglect, even after it's been pointed out by the therapist, it can be problematic to try to make it a focus early in the therapy. I have found that the concept of emotional neglect is, like other painful insights, best accepted by the client after a strong therapeutic alliance has been developed. While treating the presenting problem, the therapist will have the opportunity to point out examples of emotional neglect as they arise. Piece by piece, the case will be built so that when the full concept of emotional neglect is finally presented to the client, it can become a meaningful, useful model for understanding himself. 2. Counter the counterdependence. Because of the counterdependence, it is a general tendency for emotionally neglected clients to leave treatment as soon as they feel some relief from their presenting problem. I believe that the best way to treat counterdependence is to work hard to keep emotionally neglected patients in therapy as long as they are benefiting, while continuously pointing out and challenging their counterdependence every step of the way. Therapists may sometimes find that it requires a significant amount of energy to simply keep emotionally neglected clients from terminating treatment before they are ready. But for the emotionally neglected, keeping them in therapy not only allows them to do the work of therapy, it is the work of therapy. In essence, the emotional neglect patient will benefit greatly from experiencing a healthy dependence on her therapist, which, as a child, she was not able to feel with her parents. Each time the patient makes one of the counterdependent statements mentioned earlier in the section on counterdependence in the therapy, it's very important to catch it and address it directly. She may make this comment in many different ways at different points in the treatment. Each time she says it, she is offering the therapist an opportunity to address one of her core issues, counterdependence, from a different angle. Here are questions that have helped me access this core issue. Do you think it's bad to need another person's help? Why? Where in your childhood did you get the message that you shouldn't need help? What does needing me, relying on me, depending on me, make you feel? Were there any people in your childhood upon whom you felt comfortable relying? Do you think everyone else has already worked out all their issues? Would you judge your friend for going to therapy? Do you believe there's a time limit for therapy? Do you know what counterdependence is? Then name it and define it for her. Are you afraid that I'll disappoint you, abandon you, hurt you in some way? Are you worried that I might be judging you for needing help? Why do you hold yourself to impossible standards? Do you realize that you're not allowing yourself to be human? These are some examples, but there are an infinite number of ways to challenge the counterdependence. Of course, the client will make the decision in the end, but the point is that the therapist will need to take every opportunity to address counterdependence head-on. I have found that it is most helpful to think of my patient's difficulty staying in therapy not as an inconvenience, but as an opportunity. 3. Build tolerance for emotion. Cognitive behavioral, psychodynamic, psychoanalytic, medical, substance abuse, family, marriage, inpatient, outpatient or day treatment, mental health professionals all deal with a lot of emotion in their practices. While it is true that most people come to therapy for reasons involving difficulties with emotional health, the emotionally neglected patient can be particularly challenging in the specific area of emotional knowledge and tolerance. Since the language of emotion is so foreign and the experience of emotion is so uncomfortable, this aspect of treatment can be the most challenging. I suggest a gradual exposure model when it comes to helping the emotionally neglected client become more comfortable with feelings. In terms of therapeutic style, think of this as systematic desensitization as opposed to implosive therapy. I've used the Identifying and Naming exercise, Chapter 6, Section 3, with a number of emotionally neglected clients in my office. Conducting this exercise during a session can be useful in two ways: assessing the client's ability to sit with and report emotion, and building tolerance for emotion. One emotionally neglected client, when asked to sit with me, close his eyes, focus inward, and ask himself what he was feeling, immediately opened his eyes wide and said, "I just went totally numb." It was a light bulb moment in the treatment for both him and me. At that moment, we knew our starting point, and we continued to use this exercise throughout the treatment with the initial goal of not going numb. It is very important for the therapist to point out emotion when you see or hear it in a session. Many therapists do this regularly, and with the emotionally neglected client, it is of special importance. Speak the language of emotion in the therapy. Ask the client what he thinks someone else was feeling. Ask him what he himself was feeling. Ask him what he is feeling right here, right now. The previous three questions are placed in order of least to most difficult for the emotionally neglected patient. I have found that it is very helpful to ask these clients what they were feeling when certain events happened in their childhood. For example, remember Kathleen with the sand play memory from Chapter 1, who was able to identify the reasons for her adult anger at her mother by being asked in therapy to describe her emotional response to a seemingly innocuous statement her mother made in childhood. Or Simon from Chapter 3, who was irritated by my emotion-based questions in therapy, but who was finally, in the end, healed by those very questions. Reflect your client's feelings back to her when she is unaware. You're saying it's no big deal, yet you look really sad about it. Or, you say it didn't bother you, yet I can hear the anger in your voice. Additionally, it is very important for the therapist to allow himself to feel while he is with the client and to be authentic with his own emotional responses, while keeping the therapeutic boundary, of course. 4. Provide mirroring. This aspect of the treatment ties together several previously discussed facets of emotional neglect, all of which involve increasing self-knowledge. This is not the same issue or process as identity. I have found that emotionally neglected patients typically have a well-developed identity. The problem is that they are not familiar enough with it. As discussed previously, the emotionally neglected adult typically grew up without accurate feedback from his primary caregivers regarding who he is. This leaves him with either distorted self-knowledge or very little self-knowledge. As adults in treatment, they may struggle to define what they want, what they can and can't do, and who they actually are. In this regard, it can be useful to talk about the parental mirror with the emotionally neglected client directly. Since it is hard for the client to see what wasn't reflected back, the concept of the parental mirror can provide her with a clear, visual sense of what didn't happen for her. Once the client understands what she didn't get, the therapist can help her complete her own picture by becoming the mirror for her. This means carefully observing everything about, for example, her preferences, learning style, cognitive style, aesthetics, strengths, weaknesses, and relational style. Then feed it back to her whenever possible, in a manner that she can take in. She may see herself reflected in the therapist's eyes, or learn about herself via the therapist's verbal observations. Either way, she will gradually become more familiar with who she is. Along with this, it's important to make sure that the client knows that, in total, in the big picture, she has quality. She must get the message from her therapist that it's okay if she has weaknesses and faults, and if she dislikes some things or people. She still has other strengths and other things and people that she does like. This is the sense of balanced self-view and self-esteem that will sustain her through challenges, disappointments, and even failures. 5. Provide the balanced, healthy parental voice. One of the most vital things missing from the internal world of the emotionally neglected adult is the balanced, integrated inner voice that we are all meant to have, which talks us through difficult times, helps us understand and learn from our mistakes, and in some ways serves as our own personal sounding board. Living life without this emotional anchor can leave the emotionally neglected untethered and vulnerable to life's challenges. Many emotionally neglected clients have expressed to me a feeling that they are not in control of their own lives, that they go where the tide takes them and simply try to make the best of wherever they end up. Remember Josh in Chapter 3, who had great difficulty choosing and committing to a career, and then stopped teaching as soon as he received some criticism? Or Noelle, also in Chapter 3, who became paralyzed by her own harsh internal voice? Neither Josh nor Noelle had a parent who reflected back, talked them through their mistakes, or gave them a balanced, reality-based voice which they could internalize. As adults, they each had difficulty staying resilient through life's challenges. An important part of the treatment of the emotionally neglected is therefore providing them with that balanced voice. The therapist should lead the client through an examination of his negative experience, whether it is a criticism, failure, or mistake. Help him consider the reasons the event occurred and what to do about it, while maintaining an integrated, compassionate stance. Each time this happens, the client will have the opportunity to learn how to think through these types of situations for himself in a balanced, thoughtful, compassionate manner. This will help him become less likely to make the same mistake or to fold when faced with a challenge in the future. 6. Resist the urge to indulge your client. Why am I suggesting that the therapist might have such an urge? The answer has nothing to do with the therapist. It has everything to do with the emotionally neglected client. As we've talked about before, emotionally neglected clients tend to go back and forth between extreme self-castigation and letting themselves completely off the hook. As therapists, our goal is to neutralize both of those internal voices by providing a third, alternative voice, a voice which holds the client accountable in a balanced and caring way, a voice which compassionately speaks the truth. The emotionally neglected client, as evidenced by the back-and-forth process mentioned previously, not only has a ruthless internal voice, she also is skilled at self-indulgence. She will have an unconscious tendency to pull for the therapist to not hold her accountable. In her mind, she has two choices. She is either absolved or excoriated. It is understandable that she would repeatedly choose to be absolved of any wrongdoing. Furthermore, since the emotionally neglected client is probably quite likable, the therapist might find it difficult to hold her accountable. But if the therapist notices that she is not trying her hardest, for example, he must say, "I believe you can do better." When the therapist sees her making poor choices, he must speak the truth for her and help her think it through. When the therapist sees her being too easy on herself, he must tell her this in a caring way, in a way that neutralizes the two extreme sides of her own internal voice and creates a third voice, compassionate, yet firm and challenging. 7. Challenge self-castigation. This natural aspect of most therapy becomes particularly important with the emotionally neglected. The therapist must stay vigilant to every word, every implication, every facial expression, and every subtle overtone which signals that the patient may be beating himself up by either word or thought. When this occurs with the therapist present, it is an opportunity for the therapist to make the patient aware of the self-destructive voice and the damage it is doing. After building the client's awareness, it will be more effective when the therapist models the words, balance, and strength to be found in self-compassion. The goal is for him to internalize this voice so that over time it will become his own. Summary for the therapist. Watch for the subtle signs. If you suspect emotional neglect, use the diagnostic tool. Point out the signs of emotional neglect with care while you treat the presenting condition. Be the mirror to build self-knowledge. Be the voice of balance, compassion, and challenge. Don't indulge, but continually challenge self-blame and self-directed anger. Counter the counter-dependence. Welcome, speak, and build tolerance for emotion. Provide the watchful, caring, reality-based relationship that he did not have with his parents. Help him build self-compassion and self-care. Conclusion. I hope that my concept of emotional neglect will resonate with the experience of other clinicians and that it will spark the curiosity of researchers. There are several testable assumptions underlying this model. What is the frequency with which the identified emotional neglect symptoms occur together? Is that frequency at a high enough level to suggest that they are related to each other via an underlying syndrome? What is the correlation between the results of the emotional neglect questionnaire and therapists' independent perception of emotional neglect in their clients? Does the emotional neglect questionnaire have inter-rater reliability and validity? Can the emotional neglect questionnaire's reliability and validity be improved by adding or subtracting certain questions? Does treatment progress better when the concept of emotional neglect is utilized appropriately by the therapist? These are just a few of the questions that I believe warrant scientific examination. I am highly interested in pursuing them and hope that others will be similarly motivated. My greatest hope for this book is that it will advance the concept of emotional neglect, bringing it out of the darkness and into the light, and most importantly, that it will bring clarity, self-awareness, solace, and strength to many well-deserving people who have not yet realized what they never got in childhood. This concludes Running on Empty by Janice Webb, PhD. Narrated by Karen White. Copyright 2013 by Janice Webb, PhD. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Janice Webb and was produced in the year 2015 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.